Previously on the Critical Mass Podcast.
Is this thing on? Okay.
I seen it happen. Eat a duck.
You saw a catfish eat a duck?
It's fuel for the imagination.
Do you hear things too?
Sound bites. Keep them frozen. They're good.
I hear someone.
No, don't turn it down.
You're listening to the Critical Mass Podcast. I'm Winston. My co-host Curtis is not joining me today. Instead, I have author Phil Elmore in the reaction chamber with me. His new book, Augment Human Services, is available right now on Kindle and other ebook formats. And we talk a little bit. Phil's a frequent guest. We are always excited to discuss his forays into action adventure novels. So we talk a bit about Mac Bolan and some of his other work, including a novella series that he is releasing, or a serial novel, I think is the way he phrased it, that he is releasing right now on his website at philelmore.com. And of course, other readers may know Phil as the author and editor of The Martialist, For Those Who Fight Unfairly, a magazine, an e-zine dedicated to self-defense and other things. Phil's a great guy, and we've got some great stuff to talk about, so we're going to get right into that in just a second. I want to give everybody a reminder that the Opposing Forces Kickstarter is still going on, so if you haven't gone over to Kickstarter and checked that out, please do. Opposing Forces is a 192-page tactical manual and bestiary of foes for Fate Core. In the first part of the book, I lay out the mathematics behind running a conflict in the Fate system, and then the next three quarters of the book is dedicated to providing you with character archetypes and opponents, a gallery of opponents ready to do battle or conflict or lawyeries or whatever your Fate Core campaign is about. So there's the advertisement. That's cool. Let's move forward. Phil is waiting for me in the reaction chamber. All right. Well, I am in the reaction chamber with author and guest Phil Elmore. How's New York?
Well, we'll eventually have summer. I can't tell you when, but we will.
I am keeping my fingers crossed. Summer. I'm just keeping my fingers crossed that it does eventually get here. You're right. So I just
it's like a Roland Emmerich film over the winter. It was just awful.
So I just finished your latest Super Bolan Terror Ballot. And I quite enjoyed that. Matt goes on a rampage through Paris, rooting out political corruption and gangs and other things. You want to give us a little peek behind the scenes of what goes into your executioner novels and some of the things that, because you've been writing executioners and other Mac Bolan adventures for multiple years now.
Yes, 2006, I think. I know that I've written, in terms of executioners, I think it's over 20. I'd actually have to go and look at the list because I've written some that haven't come out yet. So the official count is kind of worked out. But I mean, we're closing in on 2,000. And I'm an amateur compared to some of the authors who've been writing in that series.
Oh yeah, guys like Mike Newton who've been around since the 80s.
Yeah, and Jerry Van Cook, who is the author who was very helpful to me in helping me get the job. I owe him quite a bit in gratitude for that. He's written, it's got to be scores of them. I can't even remember now, but I had a babysitter once years ago when I was a kid, and I remember complaining because I was going to miss Dukes of Hazzard because it was bedtime with Sonny. She looked at me and she said, "You know that the fat guy in the white suit is going to have some nefarious plan, and the two guys in the orange car will jump over something and stop him, don't you? Just like that, every episode of Houston Hazard was ruined for him.
Oh.
Except that it wasn't, because the fact is, human beings love formula. Now, yes, you like variety in our formula, but when it comes to, you may have heard of Save the Cat and the beat sheet that goes with that, you know, it's this idea that all entertainment can be broken down into a set of beats and predictable plot occurrences that fit into a template. The books that I write, I don't plot them out quite that regimented in terms of formula, but when you've been writing about a character who has existed for, what is it, it's got to be 700 books worth now, and you add up all the series, the Super Bowl and the Executioners and the Crossovers and everything, you know, Mac has lived enough life and should be, what, in his 70s by now? The man was originally in Vietnam and still he managed to keep on fighting. So trying to do new things with him and trying to stay within the very close confines of what they'll allow you to do, you know, the publisher has a very marketable, very homogenous product that they're happy with. They're not going to let you suddenly have Mac have a crisis of conscience and question this vigilante thing he's been doing and decide to settle down in a Buddhist monastery until someone calls it back to action, which is itself another action trope, you know, the I'm putting down my guns until I pick them back up.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. When Chuck Dixon was editing for Marvel Comics, he once wrote that every now and then he would field a pitch for the Punisher, a character that owes quite a lot to Mac Bolan, where somebody would write in with, oh, I've got the ultimate Punisher story. And in every single one of the stories, you know, Frank Castle accidentally kills an innocent and lays down his guns to join the priesthood until called back into action. And it's...
it's funny that you mention that, because that's the one thing that the Executioner can never do. The problem with Punisher Warzone, the one with Ray Stevenson, is that right at the beginning of that movie, he kills the wrong guy and has a sense of doubt throughout the rest of the movie.
Right.
A character like Mac Bolan is not a dynamic character. He is a fixed point around which the action of the rest of the novel rotates. You can introduce new characters to interact with them. You can give him unusual villains. You can get him partners for him to talk to and people whose attitudes are different so that in his reflection we can see those differences highlighted. But you're not allowed to change that bone. He's the ultimate paladin figure. So because he's unchanging and ever fixed, he must remain righteous because if he does not have his moral righteousness intact, he loses the power to go around shooting people in the face and always be correct. So you can't ever allow him to make a mistake. He does not ever doubt what he's doing. He does not ever go, gosh, what if maybe my country isn't right above all else all the time?
Right.
You know, and yeah, he's allowed to be a little cynical within the context of, you know, contemporary geopolitics, but really, Mac Bolan is the ultimate flag-waving paladin hero who always does the right thing. And because he always does the right thing, the wrongs of others are highlighted against that backdrop.
Right.
So, you know, you look at books that I've written, you will see similarities in the Mac Bolan novels that I've written. I do some of the same tricks. I maybe do usually the same gags, although hopefully never quite the same exactly twice. When you write the first book, and you use all your best stuff, and this is the dream you've had to write one of these books, and it comes out, and they give you a big box of them, and you hand them out to all your friends, and you're really happy. And then you write a second book, and you're so excited to write that second book, and you put everything you've got in the, what about the third or the fifth book? You're like, wait, I've done everything I ever wanted to do with the Executioner. What now? And now
right.
There's a gun to your face. And that gun to your face is, you know, there's a deadline. And if you want to do this, you've got to produce. And, you know, a lot of people who write their first book, they may take months, they may take years. Most amateur authors, I've assumed it's years. I know it took me years to write my first book. You write these executioner novels in months, not years. And you have to get the job done, and it has to be acceptable. It has to conform to standards. You have to not violate the established, not just canon, but sort of the established persona. You know, Mac's not allowed to suddenly have a personality inversion You know, right. It helps if you've read the books as I did as a teenager for years, you know, I'm familiar with the series.
Right.
But what it comes down to is you are producing a very similar product every time you write one of these books. So the task is, how do I make this one interesting? So every time I do one, even if it's, you know, the concepts or the themes may be similar, as they would have to be for somebody who's had hundreds of audits.
Right.
But every time I write one, I think, what is the action scene I want to read?
Right.
What is the... I create a situation and I go, okay, what's the most satisfying way for an action hero to enter and exit this situation? Because we all, I think, project a little bit of ourselves into an action novel when we read it. We all dream of being the indestructible, strong hero to some degree.
Well, if it's a good action novel, I would argue that that's part of the purpose. That's one of the joys of reading it.
Absolutely. So, you know, when you write the product, you just say, okay, how do I make this scene interesting? I've told people I've never written a novel. I've written 20 to 25 chapters every single time. And
right.
Each time I write one chapter, is this the action scene that I want to read?
Right.
You know, the exception being the exposition chapter, which generally happens right up front to establish why we're here and what we're doing.
Right.
Because these aren't mystery novels, that's done typically at the outset. And that requires a little bit of, thought in terms of, okay, I've got to cover everything I need to cover, but not too much, because there are things that will get revealed later. So what are those things?
Right.
That's part of the plotting process.
The Mack Bolan formula, the action-adventure serial formula, exists in the way it does for the reason that it has stood the test of time. And there's nothing wrong with formula when it's well executed. I often hold up the cartoon on Disney XD, or one of the Disney channels, Phineas and Ferb, as a triumph of formula in execution, because every single one of the, you know, like you mentioned, the Duke Boys, every single one of these cartoons is the same. Phineas and Ferb make some improbable machine. Their platypus pet is a secret agent who foils the evil genius, and the sister tries to bust them with Mom and fails. And it's every single one of them. I mean, the running gags are slightly different, and they're repeated from show to show. But the formula is so strong and is so strongly executed in this show that they did an entire episode where they reinterpreted the main characters into caveman times and had them all speaking caveman speak, not it was quonka da quonka gonk and onka donker hog hog, they were speaking gibberish. But just watching the show and knowing the formula, we were laughing at the same jokes, and it really is well executed. And Mack Bolan is the same kind of creature. Once you've got the bad guy identified, and once you know what the mission is, everything else is a matter of execution. Like you said, what cool things is he going to do this time around? How are we going to get from A to B? And what's going to happen to the villains and the supporting cast and all these other things in the meantime? Because Max, our hero, we know that he's going to pull through, even if he gets beat up a bit. We want to see how everybody else does.
Well, I think it's also the ultimate justice fantasy fulfillment. We all want to live in a world where evil gets shot in the face. We all want to know that the bad guys get what they want. And
yes,
that world is a world where that happens without fail.
Yeah. There's a lot to be said for that. Well, that's Mack Bolan. You've got some new books coming out and a big library of Mack Bolan titles. If people are interested in picking up your previous action adventure stuff. But why don't we mention one of the projects that you've got going on right now that we can point people to?
Well, if Mack Bolan is the triumph of certainty over all else, it's fun to explore something with a little bit more moral ambiguity. And I started a series of novellas called Augment. The first one of which is called Augment Human Services, which is available right now on Amazon. Now it is a novella. It's 90,000 words is basically the first third of a full-length novel, and there are two more thirds on the way. So be aware of that when you buy it. It is a fast read for that reason. And it's a science fiction novella set in the near future in which body modification culture has become a kind of pervasive cultural sickness for no reason that anyone can quite define. And these creatures called augments, who in some cases are just a brain and a spinal cord inside the body of a robot, that run the gamut from that all the way down to people with cybernetic enhancements, are enclosed in ghettos by day, or by night rather, and sometimes allowed out during the day, and are really second-class citizens. And of course, part of the reason for this is they're dangerous, and part of the reason for this is that people are a complex collage of hatreds and prejudices. So it's fertile ground. There's a lot of, I don't know if you call it hard science fiction, but certainly science fiction that explores social issues. It's fertile ground for exploring people's biases and attitudes and cultural interactions where there is no easy answer. Because it's not like, oh, this poor persecuted minority. Well, no, the persecuted minority is also very, very dangerous in some cases. So we follow the adventures of an agent Chalmers, who is he works for a government agency. His job is to recover minors who have gone over to this body modification culture, because there are several laws that govern who's allowed to do this and who is not. So if your teenage daughter who's not yet at the age of consent decides she wants to enter the ghetto and become one of the audience, it's Mr. Chalmers' job to go in there and get your child out of there. But of course, in so doing, he's facing some very, very dangerous people, in a way that would seem familiar if you were watching any number of movies about the clash of cultures. You've got the strong-jawed square walking into the room of evil hippies, which you've seen play out in any number of 60s and 70s action movies, all the way back to the 50s in Black Boy Jungle, you know, that kind of idea.
Well, so augment, I really liked Augment. It was, I wish I had known going in that it was going to be quite as graphically brutal as it was. And maybe the level of violence is one up from the action novels that I'm used to reading. Or, you know, maybe it's just me. It's a very dirty, gritty, cyberpunk kind of world. I mean, this is a nasty place. Geek culture has personified technology as making life better. The future is going to be better and brighter. And even when that future is kind of grim and used a little bit, it's still going to be better for everybody. And one of my takeaways from Augment was that this world isn't necessarily a place that technology has improved. And not in the whole environmental, we're ruining the world kind of way, but rather in the very personal way where technology has come in and just absolutely stripped away the things that matter to us as people and dehumanized this entire segment of the population that at a point in their lives when they are most vulnerable to this happening. And I found it I just found it to be a very grim setting. And I finished the first part, Human Services, and am anxiously awaiting to see where we go from here.
Well, it's funny. The world portrayed in Human Services is the darker side of this world. I wanted to portray what it's like for technology to be perverted towards the purpose of people ruining themselves for reasons that are not clear unless you are that person. We all look at the guy with the stainless steel sockets in his scalp who likes to screw spikes into them, or those people who have those stupid giant channels in their ears, or the picture that's been floating around of the guy with the metal holes in his cheek that lets you see right through the side of his head. You know, we look at that and we're revolted by it. We're disgusted by it. We don't understand why someone would do that to themselves. But to the person who did that, it was extremely important. So much option to do it. So I just took that to a ridiculous extreme and made it, you know, what if instead of getting those gauges in my earlobes, I wanted to become a cyborg? You know, and you take that idea and you play with it. The original inspiration for all that was I had this idea for a short story in which a detective-type character is outside a nightclub, and he's strapping on his armor because the robot or cyborg creatures inside the nightclub is so big and heavy that if he's not armored, a collision with one of them could seriously injure him. And from that initial idea, which I think I had in a dream at some point, sometimes you wake up and you're like, I should remember that idea. Because it's weird and it's possibly useful. From that, the whole world of augment developed because I started out by creating a sort of a Star Wars cantina full of weird augmented creatures and coming up with different ways that people might do that, all based on current body modification culture. And then said, okay, now what if I've got this strong-jawed, you know, square dude who's working for the government and he has a job to do, and he's pretty no-nonsense about it. And he's not afraid to piss on with you if you get in his way. And so you introduce that character, and you sort of, it took a little while to find his personality in that.
Right.
And then where you go from there is, okay, now, well, what if it's not all simple answers? What if it's not all black and white? Some of them are good, some of them are bad. Some of them are beautiful, some of them are wonderful. I've written a series of short stories that help me explore that world that I am going to release as a collection. There will be another novella-length collection. I'm still working on, like, the capstone story for that.
Oh, but very good.
I explore augment families who are perfectly nice. You know, what's it like to be someone who becomes an augment against their will and runs afoul of these laws that say, well, you know, if you're more than 33% augmented machine, then you're not a person anymore. You're an augment. So this can happen against your will in the world that I'm creating. So I explored that. You know, just all kinds of different angles. I even did my very first ever detective story and made the detective an augmented Sherlock Holmes type character, you know, and you know, how would that work? So it gave me a lot of freedom to explore different aspects of the same world. Recently, I did a new series on my website at philomore.com called 4104, which I'm probably going to change the name when I actually compile it and make it a book, just because 4104 is not a company descriptive name, so it you kind of want people to have some idea what the book is about before they pick it up.
Right.
I set it in the same world, so I didn't have to reinvent all the same conventions, at roughly the same time period, but far, far away from where the action of augmented services takes place. You know, if augmented is taking place in the United States, then 4104 takes place in Hong Kong somewhere, very far away, different rules, different legal structure.
Certainly.
And then I explored something entirely different. 4104 was inspired by a South Korean action movie, actually. I was watching The Man from Nowhere, which, if you've never seen it, is there's this government agent who's he lost his wife and unborn child, and so he's just kind of living out his life, working in a little pawn shop kiosk, and a little girl whom he's made friends with, she and her mother, one of ours, drug dealers, get kidnapped, and our hero basically stabs the entire population of a South Korean city in order to get the little girl back. And the idea of this just implacable, driven, almost a monster he becomes. Just, there's nothing that will stop him because he's trying to save that little girl. There's a climactic action scene where he's like stabbing people and dragging them across the floor and stabbing them while he's dragging them, all while inexorably moving towards his goal, which is the bad guy who have captured the little girl. And I thought to myself, what would that be like if it was a father determined to get to his child in a world where he is the unstoppable force for some reason? So I created 4104, and its main character is a fellow named Ian Payton, who has been biologically augmented to be enormously strong. He's much larger than a ordinary person. He's very nearly unkillable. He's not immortal, but it takes a lot to bring him down.
Right.
And when he finds out that he has a daughter, he breaks out of prison and eventually finds her. They begin living life on the run as the law is trying to find her. And eventually she is kidnapped by the government agency that is responsible for all of this. And he then gets a chance to do that that unstoppable force fighting its way through any number of objects to get to his goal type of story that we wanted to do.
Right.
The third one I'll feel was different than anything I've written before, because I wrote it first as a short story, and then I thought, well, let's write a couple more short stories with these same characters. I like them. I'd like to explore what their dynamic is like. And then I sat down and I plotted out a plot arc that would encompass 50 episodes, all of anywhere between 1,000 and 1,500 words. So, you know, a full-length novel story.
Right.
But broken into 50 parts that are releasing on my website, they're all written and programmed in, and that story will finally conclude in December at Philomo.com. It comes out every Friday, and releases automatically. I put it all in there. I mean, I have to remember to do it. It just publishes itself.
Very good.
And eventually, I will take that down from my website and compile it as a book and sell it as a book. It's, like I said, a different title. But
right.
I fell in love with 4104 because I really enjoyed writing the dynamic of basically a criminal, a fugitive, who is also a father, whose primary concern is not, you know, how do I be the best criminal I can be, but is, am I a good father? And he's asking himself that question throughout the story. You know, what kind of life am I giving my daughter as we flee from flop house to flop house? They kill a lot of child molesters along the way. That became the theme of the book. It wasn't really my intent, but it ended up, you know, being that way, and I kind of enjoyed doing it just because, you know, all of us wouldn't enjoy being child molesters killed. So, you know, because we have a creature who is essentially a monster.
Right.
Giving him free reign to crush the skulls of some of the most wretched people in the world is just too much fun to pass up. There's no reason that the book shouldn't have an entertainment value to it. It comes purely from enjoying seeing the bad get gotten.
Right. Well, you know, some evil people just need to have their skulls crushed in. These things need to happen.
Yeah, I think it was Tim Green, who must have a really good contract with Satan because there's nothing he hasn't done. He wrote a novel about a guy who basically lost his child, so his new hobby became executing child molesters. He also wrote another book called Exact Revenge, which is a contemporary retelling of the Count of Monte Cristo story, which was notable because it was set in more or less the area where I spent about 20 years living and working. Instead of going to the Chateau Bouchard, his hero goes to Auburn Prison in upstate New York. And those were great examples of, again, that justice fulfillment. You know,
sure.
People say we love revenge stories, and
right.
To a certain extent that's true. But very few of us hate another human being so much that we would be willing to hurt ourselves or die in order to get to them. Most of what we want is justice. We just want to see bad people get what's coming to them. And there's a real satisfaction in even seeing fictional bad people get what they deserve.
Yeah, I really like your phrase there, justice fulfillment, because most of these, most of the time you hear this, this type of genre, this type of convention discussed, it's with the phrase revenge fantasy or, wish fulfillment or, you know, power fantasy. And these aren't compliments. These are criticisms labeled at the genre, dismissing them as literature, dismissing them as worthwhile entertainment. But when you take it from the other direction, when you take it as this isn't about revenge, this is about justice, this is about seeing bad people get what's coming to them for bad things, it puts a more worthwhile dimension on it. And so I really like that, that's your approach to much of this. I think it has served you well in the past, and I'm certain that it will continue to do so in the future.
You know, the thing that in the case of Mac Mullen, but I think in terms of all action heroes, we all relate to the character who, like in Kill Bill or any other type of revenge movie, yes, they've been horribly mistreated, and we do want to see them get the people that mistreated them. But what do the people who mistreat them all have in common? They're terrible human beings. They're just the wonderful people who you know, one day, the bad guy woke up and accidentally did something to ruin the protagonist's life.
Whoops.
One good example of that played out is there's that Dwayne Johnson movie, Faster, I enjoyed the movie because it starts out with him running to get to the car that's going to enable him to get to the rest of the movie, which I thought was a great metaphorical way to start the film. And he runs around, basically he's getting revenge on people who killed his brother and left him for dead. And we can all relate to, yes, they're very bad people and you're very upset about your brother.
Right.
But he gets to, spoiler alert if you haven't seen the film, he gets to one of them. And this guy has genuinely turned his life around. And there's a reason to want to spare this man. But of course, Dwayne Johnson also wants to get revenge for the terrible thing that was done to his brother.
Right.
Meanwhile, he has killed someone who very much deserved it, but whose son keeps calling him on his father's phone. So now he's living with the notion right there in the car with him, as embodied by that phone, I just killed a father. I killed somebody who, despite the fact that he was evil and did wrong, was loved by someone and is missed by someone.
Right.
So that movie, while it's a popcorn flick and it's Dwayne Johnson with a giant revolver and a muscle car running around shooting people in the head, it's also, it has a layer of moral, not ambiguity, but almost moral justness. And by that I mean, he has to live with what he's done, but not necessarily right. You know, you got the comeback that was coming for you, but you affected other lives. And in the movie universe, any one of those people could then hunt you down and have righteous justification for wanting to kill you. It's Kill Bill, when she says to the daughter of one of the horrible people, hey, you know, when you grow up, if you want to come find me and kill me, I understand. That's how this works.
Right. No, they've done that on the TV show Supernatural before. They've done more than one episode, I'm sure, but the one that sticks in my mind has one of the heroes, Dean, I think, Jensen Ackles, maybe.
Jensen Ackles plays Dean.
Right. He kills this monster and, you know, turns around and there's the kid. And, the kid's all terrified and, you know, are you going to kill me too? And, you know, Dean basically says, well, you know, if I have to, I will. And the kid's like, well, one of these days I'm going to hunt you down and kill you. And, he says, you know, if you feel you have to, when you get big enough, I'll be ready. You know, but it highlighted to me the fact that, you know, he's not really acting out of, he's not a psycho killer. He's not acting out of revenge. These aren't personal killings. This is justice from another, you know, justice for those who are outside of the existing system of justice. And even so, he understands that, what he's doing is not necessarily going to, it's not something that that is going to win him any friends, and it doesn't necessarily put him in in favor. Maybe he's acting in the moral right, but you know, not everybody's going to see it that way. But anyway,
well, I think action novels can really be divided into three basic types. You've got revenge, where it's a personal motivation, and we're along for the ride. We find it fulfilling because we love seeing bad people get what's coming to them.
Excellent.
It's justice where, you know, in a more overarching sense, we love to see the right thing done right. We want to see good triumph over evil. So justice encompasses all of good versus evil type, contests.
Okay.
And then finally there's the rescue me. You know, it's my daughter has been kidnapped. The entire city is being held hostage by a nuclear bomb threat. Any episode of 24, which has just come back, it's Jack Bauer does what he does not for personal revenge, although that's certainly a motivation in smaller chunks, but his overall motivation throughout the entire series is, I must save the city. I must prevent the city or the country or the world from being destroyed. And there are so many bad people that are trying to destroy it that it justifies any short-term evil that I do to accomplish a short-term goal. The entire books can and have been written about Jack Bauer as a character because he represents the ultimate short-term goal action hero who will do anything to accomplish goal A when there's still A to B to C to D to go to get to the end.
Right.
And often, his short-term decisions complicate his longer-term ones, but he doesn't really think past that, because in order to keep this guy in this liquor store until the satellite flew overhead, I had to rob the place and take everyone hostage.
Well, Phil, I've kept you on the phone for quite a while, and we're coming up on time. So, is there anything else that that we need to talk about or to mention before we go? Now, it wouldn't be a Phil Elmore guest appearance if we didn't at least mention Duke Manfist, the world's manliest action hero.
Well, the irony is that Duke Manfist, my parody of the very action genre that I've been writing in for so many years, is also the body of work that I've contributed the most entries to, because it just, how do I say this? Duke Manfist is written really badly. And it's deliberately written badly because bad writing is funny. And Duke Manfist is meant to be funny above all else. It's interesting to me to see the reviews, and some people get it, and
some people
don't understand.
Don't.
You know, this was probably not the book for you, nice lady. You know,
right.
Because Duke is not just badly written, he's also sexist and overbearing and just absurd to the nth degree. All of the Duke Manfist adventures that have been written have been published. They are all available on Amazon. There's the compilation of season one, which is Duke Manfist, Bullets, Babes, and Bacon. And then there are the seasonal novellas we did. There's Thanksgiving with My Fist, Twas the Night Before Duke Manfist Saved Christmas, Duke Manfist and the Gert Permkern, which is our Halloween episode.
Right.
I feel like I'm leaving one out because I've forgotten one.
No, that's it. That's all I've got.
I actually am planning to write another one, called Duke Manfist and the Legend of Matumba's Gold, working title.
Sweet.
Just because I always wanted to do a story about the legend of somebody's gold. So.
Very cool.
Duke is the greatest opportunity to just do whatever you want, because the more absurdity, better. So I really love writing it. It always brings a smile to my face.
Yeah, and I got to admit, out of all of those, I think "Twas the Night Before Duke Manfist Saved Christmas" is still my favorite.
Well, not to spoil the ending, but I promise anyone who reads Twas the Night Before Duke Manfist Saved Christmas, you will get to the last line of that, almost to the last line of that novella, and you will laugh. I hate to sound arrogant, because I don't mean it that way, but I wrote it, and it still makes me cry with laughter when I think about it, just because it's such an absurd way to end the book.
That's not a threat. It's a promise.
So yes, and the nice thing about Twas the Night Before Duke Manfist Saved Christmas is that you can read it to your children every year at Christmas time if you would like to scar them permanently for the holidays.
I may consider doing that. Oh, goodness. Well, Phil, thank you very much. Did we leave anything out?
I don't think so. League Entertainment, the IP development firm with which I work, we've got a number of projects forthcoming, including the fourth tie-in novella that goes with the Simon Vector science fiction franchise.
Yes.
That one is the story of Colonel Rex Mason, who was a very popular character from the original Simon Vector. And I don't know a release date for that, but I do know that has been written and will be coming out eventually. So looking forward to that myself. I can't wait to read it.
Very good. Keep our eyes peeled. We'll keep watching for it. Well, Phil, thank you very much for spending some time with me. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show, on the phone.
Oh, thank you, Winston. Anytime.
Links to all of Phil's projects, the stuff we talk about in here, can be found in the show notes, or you can check out his website at themarshalist.com or philelmore.com. Also, the League Entertainment at leagueent.com. That one's a little counterintuitive. Look for the links. But there's good stuff there. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you again. I hope to have some more interviews coming up. I've got some great people lined up to talk to, and of course, Curtis will be back on the microphone with me just to, as soon as I can trick him into visiting again. So, y'all have a nice night. Thanks for listening.
Podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 3.0 license.